This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
So 2017 has come and gone, and a lot of it was good, some of it was bad, but if I had to describe it, I'd say it was a year of change. Lots of things changed. Technology changed and new technology was introduced. The way we deal with equality and harassment at work, I think, has changed because of a few brave whistleblowers, and that will continue to take effect in 2018. Companies who were giants before and they were untouchable last year, they had to be absorbed by even bigger giants this year. And finance has changed and evolved to fit with the times. We now have an alternative form of currency that is disrupting the traditional finance sector more than ever before. And because of all this, the way we do business has changed. So I thought it'll be fun to look back on the last 12 months to see what we can learn from all the stuff that happened on a wide scale level from a business perspective and how we can apply them to our own work moving forward. Some of these lessons are from failure. Some are pretty inspirational because they come from stories of success. And the rest of it are just crazy stories of a changing business landscape and the lessons that we can learn from them. This is 5 for Fortune with Arvinya Varaj, and this episode is called 5 Business Lessons from 2017. We talk about cybersecurity every year, but 2017 has been especially notorious for its data breaches and hacks and leaks. And who can forget the WannaCry crisis, right? The WannaCry crisis that happened a few months ago, I think in May. I'm going to give each segment a name today. So to start things off, our first segment on today's episode is called Cybersecurity is Everything, and Big Companies Are Really, Really Bad at It.
Number one.
The biggest lesson we learned in 2017 when it came to cybersecurity is that all those software updates that you've been ignoring since you got your computer can and probably will come back to bite you. That's what happened with WannaCry. It wasn't even a highly sophisticated ransomware. It had a difficult time attacking all those new up-to-date systems, but because so many computers were using systems that were not properly updated on a regular basis, about 230,000 units across 150 countries were basically crippled by WannaCry in less than 24 hours. And by the time someone figured out how to stop it from spreading, about 300,000 systems were infected, causing financial losses ranging from millions to maybe even billions of dollars. Some experts even say that they estimate that the long-term loss of WannaCry could be close to $4 billion. Europol calls it the worst cyber attack in history because of how unprecedented and how wide-scale it was. But the worst part about all this is how systems in major public institutions were affected by the attack, especially in hospitals. Now, the National Health Service hospitals in England and Scotland were actually some of the worst hit by WannaCry. They lost about 70,000 devices, including computers, MRI scanners, blood storage, refrigerators, and even digital theater equipment. It got so bad to a point that the NHS services had to actually turn away non-critical patients and even divert some of their ambulances. So, and all this happened because these institutions were running vulnerable systems. Apparently, they were on Windows XP. So yeah, cyber attacks were a big deal this year. But on the other side of the argument, big companies were not that great at keeping our data safe either. We kept hearing news of hack after hack after hack that after a while it just got boring. The whole Equifax data breach happened this year, and it's still continuing to affect all those people who are involved and all the victims of this. There was also the Yahoo data breach that happened, and there was a data breach in Arby's, which is the famous American fast food joint, and Kmart. And of course, Uber popped up a bunch of times in the news for questionable data protection practices. And then on a local level, here in Malaysia, we had our own massive data breach incident where we found out that 46.2 million mobile subscribers in Malaysia which is basically all of us, since we only have a population of about 30 million. So all that data was leaked into the wrong hands. So home addresses, my card numbers, SIM card information, and all these other private details are just floating around because of the biggest data breach in our country's history. And this data was supposed to be protected by a supposedly high-tech company. Now, a few months after all that data got leaked, we're getting highly detailed scam phone calls from banks and other service providers. A couple of weeks ago, I got a call from CIMB with a recorded voice message telling me that I was overdue on my loan and to press 9. I suspected something was up because I didn't have a loan with CIMB, and when I called the bank to verify, they said it was definitely a scam. Then last week, my dad got a call from Post Malaysia saying that he had an uncollected package and to press 7 for more details. Again, it was part of a scam. So what's the lesson here in all of this? Well, one, you can never be too careful with cybersecurity. That's one. Doesn't matter if you are an individual user or if you're in a big corporation or company, or even if you're a giant like Google or Uber or Yahoo, there's always someone looking for ways to break into your system. And the second you let your guard down, they'll sneak in and the damage could be catastrophic at least and company ending at worst. It's also a pretty good reminder for smaller businesses that if big companies are having a hard time implementing proper security measures for their systems, then you're gonna have to go the extra mile to make sure that you're extra safe. We're at that stage where a lot of our private data is stored in the cloud, and because of that, we're putting a lot of trust in the services we use to protect that data. As a business, cybersecurity needs to become a priority. It doesn't matter if it's your own or someone else's. There has to be more focus and effort put into keeping digital systems safe in 2018. Right, so what's the other thing that people couldn't stop talking about in 2017? It's cryptocurrency, right? I mean, you know what it is. I'm sure someone, probably a relative, asked you about it during Christmas dinner or over the holidays. And we try explaining it to them even though we don't completely understand it either. And in the process of explaining it, we suddenly start to understand ourselves. Does that sound familiar? 2017, the year cryptocurrency went mainstream, is the second segment on today's list.
Number 2.
Most people just call cryptocurrency Bitcoin, and therein lies the problem and the lesson of this whole topic. Cryptocurrency has been around for a while now. It isn't new. And it started to really gain popularity back in 2013 when Bitcoin started making original investors a lot of money. Then slowly over the years, more companies started holding ICOs or initial coin offerings. And today we've got at least five top currencies that are doing very well in the market. So there's Ether and all of Ether's branches. Then there's Dragon Chain, which is relatively new, which is backed by Disney. And of course, there's the original Bitcoin and all of its branches and subgroups. Now, towards the end of 2017, cryptocurrency started to really enter public mainstream consciousness, but for all the wrong reasons. I'm sure you've seen all those YouTube ads where some guy is babbling about how there's this true story of someone who sold off their Bitcoin 10 years ago in exchange for pizza or something, and by doing that he lost like $50 or $500 million, some ridiculous story, which could be true, I don't know, but you have all these companies changing their names to include the word crypto in it, and you have everyone who's anyone offering up ICOs and their own coins. You've even got services implementing cryptocurrency into their system, even though they use them as basic tokens instead. Everyone, basically anyone who's anyone, wants to jump on the bandwagon without really understanding what they are getting into. So there are three camps when it comes to investing in cryptocurrency. The ones who are in it because they know there's money to be made, and the ones who think it's too good to be true. And both of these camps are wrong. The third camp is the right one, because they understand to really make a decent profit, you need to watch the markets, you need to brave the trends, and you need to know what to invest in and where. It's just like investing in stocks and shares in any early stage. There is money to be made in cryptocurrency, but you need to understand the volatility of the situation before actually investing in anything. When Bitcoin crashed in December, naysayers immediately started saying, "I told you so," again, not understanding how the market works. Crashes and dips are pretty normal in this business. Cryptocurrency is still currency. Is there a chance of the bubble bursting and investors losing everything? Sure, but it's all about waiting it out and making sure that that doesn't happen. Then you have people investing small amounts, like $1,000, and wondering why they haven't made $100,000 in 30 days. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme. You have services like Luno allowing easy Bitcoin and Ether investments, which is good, but without realizing that such huge transactions could be problematic for banks and governments who feel decentralized, which is why Luno has now blocked all cash withdrawals in Malaysia for their service until further notice. So what exactly is the lesson here? Well, first of all, businesses and individuals need to know what they're getting into before getting into it. That's just common sense at this point. But also, be careful about jumping into a crowded bandwagon. It's called FOMO, fear of missing out, in millennial speak, and it's a very real thing. We've had companies pop up here in Malaysia trying to consult others about cryptocurrency, and these companies aren't even sure of all the details themselves. And we have services and apps allowing you to easily manage your investments without going through all the proper legal procedures. And once you invest with them, your money is stuck on their track, blocked or otherwise. And because cryptocurrency is new, the rules and regulations around it is vague, which means that authorities aren't even sure about how to handle the problem if there is one. The lesson here is that it's good to be up to date on new opportunities, and cryptocurrency is definitely a new opportunity, but it's also important to know the ins and outs of something new before jumping onto that bandwagon. For individuals, just from a business standpoint, it means you could lose your investment without even knowing why. But for companies, their reputation and future is at stake. Cryptocurrency is the perfect example of a trend that's only going to grow in 2018, and it's important to be able to know what's what before putting your money into it. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk about how a giant fell and a titan grew even stronger when Disney bought 20th Century Fox. Five of Fortune will be right back, BFM 89.9.
Better Finance Management. BFM 89.9.
Hello, you're still listening to Five of Fortune. I'm Arvind Yuvaraj, and on this episode, we are looking back at 2017 and discussing lessons about business that we can learn from all these big events and business-related events that happened this year. Now, let's talk about the movies a little bit. That'll be fun. You have these giant studios making all these big movies, right? So Warner Brothers makes the Justice League and the Harry Potter movies. Disney makes the Marvel movies and the Star Wars movies. And 20th Century Fox makes Avatar and all those X-Men movies. It's always pretty shocking when you hear like major companies that suddenly merge or buy other companies, like when Disney bought Marvel and then created Marvel Studios, or when Disney bought Lucasfilm and announced Star Wars movies back in 2012. But then in 2017, we saw the biggest studio acquisition ever when Disney bought 21st Century Fox after weeks and weeks of discussion, ending up on a deal on the 14th of December 2017. Let's discuss how giants fall and titans grow for our third segment on today's episode.
Number 3.
So right off the bat, what is the lesson here? Weirdly enough, there's this saying from one of the old, one of the Star Wars prequels that goes, "There's always a bigger fish." And that's the lesson here. In business, there's always a bigger fish. And sooner or later, you'll either have to adapt to survive, or you'll have to latch onto a stronger fish or company. There's honestly so much to learn from this Fox mega merger. First, the deal was made for $52 billion, which is unprecedented. But there's also a law against monopolies in business. So to avoid the legal mess, Disney bought Fox's film and TV assets. So you have your Avatars and your X-Men's and Alien franchise, and Fox's TV assets, like all their channels and programs like The Simpsons. And now Disney also has a major stake in Fox's streaming platform, which is Hulu, which is pretty interesting moving forward to Disney's own streaming service in 2019. What Disney didn't buy was Fox's sports channel. So Fox Sports and Fox News were left alone, and Fox will be continuing to work on those things because Disney already owns ESPN and ABC News, hence avoiding a monopoly. So on one front, that's just intelligent asset picking and contract workarounds and negotiations right there. But let's look at things from Fox's side of things. Fox is a conglomerate owned by Rupert Murdoch and his family, right? And it all started from a small Australian newspaper that he inherited from his father more than 60 years ago. Murdoch's logic for the merger was very simple. He said that the breakup made sense because of new threats from online advertising and competitors who are streaming entertainment into homes via the internet. So basically, Fox just couldn't compete by themselves. They were losing money even though they had a massive movie slate coming up and a major TV studio, and the logical business decision was to cut ties. Leave it all to Disney to absorb and manage, and in return, Fox's shareholders, who include the Murdochs, will own a 25% stake in the larger Walt Disney Company. And that is just smart business. So the way this all happened is also pretty interesting, right? Disney's people met with Fox's execs a while ago and discussed buying the company, but things didn't work out and then they went their separate ways. Then one day, the media picked up the story, and this happened like weeks later, and suddenly other conglomerates like Comcast could smell blood in the water, and they started to slowly maneuver towards Fox. So just out of the blue, talk started again, and a few companies were going after Fox's properties. I mean, you have to wonder, right? Was this a way for Fox to get a better bid from Disney and all these other competitors? Maybe, we don't know. So I guess that's another lesson. Seek opportunity and strike when it's hot. The Disney-Fox deal is the perfect example of isolating sentiment and logic in any business. Fox was a family-owned business, and everyone thought that Rupert Murdoch's sons, who are Lachlan and James Murdoch, they thought that they would inherit the dynasty. But when a company is struggling or even bleeding and you can't fix it by yourself, but there is an opportunity to make a ton of money selling it off to someone who can, then that is the best possible solution, and it makes the most sense from a business perspective. Remember, there's always a bigger fish. Now, let's move away from movies and talk about mobile phones, specifically Samsung mobile phones. Remember how last year Samsung had that whole fiasco with the Galaxy S7, the one with the exploding battery? Well, they had to recall their entire series and they jumped straight into the Note 8 this year. But what do you think happened to Samsung after that whole thing? After the media reported that their phones were exploding, and when there were YouTube videos with millions of views showing these phones burning up and like literally burning up, what do you think happened to Samsung as a brand? Well, according to BBC, their stocks went up by 50% in the last 3 months of 2016. Damage control is everything. That is the name of the fourth segment on today's list.
Number 4.
Now, the Note 7 wasn't Samsung's only problem in 2016. They also got caught up in this massive corruption scandal. I'm not sure if you remember, but they are still the world's leading mobile phone manufacturer. They are actually doing better than before. The question is, how? The trick here is damage control, which is something all businesses can learn to do well. Once Samsung realized that the problem with the Note 7 wasn't just limited to a few devices and there was actually a malfunction between the hardware and the battery, the speed in which they reacted was incredible. Samsung immediately decided to recall all devices from the market, even though the damage to them would fall around the 5.3 billion area, which is huge, and they offered customers a chance to own the upcoming Samsung Galaxy S7 instead. Now, the funny thing is, customers were also given the choice of a refund when they returned their Note 7, but most customers chose to replace their phones with another Samsung product, like the S7 or the S7 Edge. There's a very interesting article on the BBC website that explains this phenomenon pretty well. According to Jan Dawson of Jackdaw Research, your own experience trumps what you read in the news or what people tell you, which means that the people who were loyal to Samsung and the Samsung brand continue to support the brand even though they were aware of the Note 7 mess up. And you have to give Samsung credit. It was also because the brand and the company, they were quick to respond and they took full responsibility for the mistake. They didn't make excuses, or they didn't try to hush it up, or they didn't try to deflect refund requests. They were willing to go all the way for customer satisfaction, and that kind of damage control worked extremely well in their favor. Another important lesson here is to not put all your eggs in one basket. See, Samsung is known for their line of smartphones, yes, but they're also very popular for their line of TVs and monitors, and they even make computer hardware. But their biggest source of business is something that not many people know of. Samsung is actually a leading manufacturer of semiconductors for phones and servers and all sorts of other chipsets. Which means that diversifying allowed them to survive the potential onslaught of the Note 7 fiasco, which, lucky for them, wasn't as bad as everyone expected it to be, but business was pretty much as usual even during a time of incredible crisis. If there's one takeaway from this, it's that damage control and the speed in which a company responds to a crisis can make all the difference in the reputation of a company, and especially how it's perceived by clients and customers. And if you are looking for a role model in this area, there's no better case study than how Samsung handled the Note 7 fiasco. Okay, final segment on today's episode. We are talking about business lessons from 2017, and there's no way we can talk about the business or lessons from the last 12 months without touching on the continued rise of online shopping and the continued decline of traditional retail, but also the unexpected evolution of retail as well. Number 5 on today's list is a segment called Retail is Dead, Long Live Retail.
Number 5.
If we're going to talk about online shopping, then the best example of how insane its growth is would be Alibaba's annual 11/11 shopping phenomenon. Think of it as Black Friday, but 10 times bigger. And it's not just shopping, it's like a festival for spending money, basically. Like, before the shopping spree begins, you have this whole gala event with the stage and all, and then all these celebrities come out, like Nicole Kidman and Pharrell Williams and Fan Bingbing. And then there's a countdown after some concerts, and everyone just goes on a shopping frenzy for 24 hours. What? It sounds insane, but let's look at the numbers for a second. 140,000 brands participated in the 11/11 event in 2017. 15 million products were listed. Top-selling products were wellness and baby products. 812 million orders were made, and Alibaba is trying to speed up their delivery service, so the first order was delivered within 12 minutes of the order, which means that 12 minutes after someone placed the order online, they got their product at their doorstep. I don't think you can leave a mall and get to your car in a parking lot in less than 12 minutes. 1.48 billion payments were processed in 24 hours, which is a massive number compared to last year's 17 billion. And finally, $25.3 billion in sales in 24 hours, which is a 40% increase from last year's numbers. This trend of online shopping isn't just confined to China or to Alibaba alone. Spikes in Black Friday sales literally made Jeff Bezos the richest man in the world in 2017 because of how share prices skyrocketed. All over the world, this trend of online shopping is becoming the default way to purchase items, and retail stores are being forced to close down. In 2017, we even saw major retailers like Toys R Us take a hit because of this. But that's not the lesson here. The lesson here is how traditional retail is unexpectedly evolving and adapting to sync with the trend of online shopping. Not all, but some. See, the one thing that online shopping cannot do is they cannot let customers touch the items that they want to buy. You have to base your decisions off pictures, and sometimes pictures can be misleading. That's why I never buy my clothes online, because I honestly don't know if anything is going to fit, and sending it back is kind of a hassle, so I can't be bothered. So what traditional brick and mortar stores are doing is stepping up to meet this need, while also giving customers some of the perks and benefits of online shopping. For example, some clothing stores display samples of the clothes that they have. You touch it, you test it, you feel it, you try it on, and you shop as you normally would, which in itself is a communal experience that some people enjoy. The stores are fitted with touchscreen panels, so if you like the item and you like what you see, you can immediately order it, and it's shipped to your house almost immediately if it's in stock. You shop and the items are sent to you just like it would in a normal online order, which means that you take away the burden of carrying shopping bags wherever you go. Another interesting concept is malls operating online spaces. You can actually see this happening with Wanutama, the mall, which now has an online one shop. I think it's oneshop.com.my or something. They basically promote items from their major retailers on the site. So let's say like from Urban Tea or Aeon or any one of their retail stores, so you can make the order online. And if you see something that you like but you're not too sure, like a t-shirt or something, then you know exactly where to go look for the item yourself, which is Wanutama. The lesson here is pretty obvious, I think. Adapt to survive. During the first half of the year, everyone was talking about how retail in a traditional sense cannot survive, about how soon all brick and mortar stores will fall. But then in the second half of the year, we started to see like traditional retail not only push back, but also adapt by taking the best parts of online shopping and meshing those elements with offline shopping and the best parts of offline shopping. I think it's pretty much the simplest lesson on this list. Technology changes and trends change with it, and business needs to adapt or sync and change with the trends to keep going. Companies need to have their finger on the pulse, and if their way isn't working anymore, then maybe it's time to change things up a bit and look into bringing new elements into the way to do business. And that's about it for today's episode, and it's also the final episode of the year. Five for Fortune will be back next week for the first show of 2018, and we'll discuss business trends to watch out for in the new year. This has been Arvind Yuvraj. That was Five for Fortune. Download the podcast on the BFM app. Remember, available on the Apple App Store or on the Play Store, depending on what mobile device you have. And also, stick around, because BizBytes should be up in just a bit. It's the final enterprise show of the year, and we will wrap it up with some pretty good tech and business stories. That is coming up next. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.